Life Show on UK Health Radio. My name's Robin Daly, hosting the show as usual today, and also founder of the UK's integrative cancer care charity, Yes to Life, supporting people with cancer in taking a broad, holistic approach to their cancer care. Today's show is part three of a series of episodes showcasing the findings of Mark Linton, resulting from over 8 years of intensive research into the mechanisms and origin of cancer. If you missed parts 1 and 2, then I strongly suggest you make a point of listening to those first. Both are available on Listen On Demand, as podcast, and on YouTube, in order that you get the most from today's conversation. I'm speaking to Mark over the internet.
Hi Mark, welcome back again for part 3 of Cancer Through Another Lens.
Hi Robin, thank you for having me.
So for anyone who's just joining us now at part 3 of the journey, I strongly recommend listening to the first 2 parts before continuing to listen to this episode, as it's highly valuable information that builds as it goes. So it's very well worth hearing from the beginning. As a reminder, I'd like to do a very top-level recap of the science that we've covered so far. So we introduced Hannah Weinberg hallmarks of cancer, which are 10 key behaviours of cancer that help with identifying the disease, and explained how you, Mark, have used the ability to be able to explain these behaviours as a benchmark to evaluate the accuracy of any theoretical model. You told us how the current mainstream theory, the somatic mutation theory, that states that it's all a matter of damaged mutated genes driving the disease, not only has some major holes in it, but it can explain very few of these hallmark behaviours. We went on to mention a raft of other theories that all have their strengths and weaknesses, but then we looked at the metabolic theory in some more detail, as this measures up much better against the hallmarks, and it can explain at least 7 out of 10. A central focus of your attention was that in 2 respects, the mainstream narrative has sought to explain cancer in a way that requires the orderly process of cancer, sufficiently orderly in fact to be characterised by at least 10 predictable hallmark behaviours, to be the result of random occurrences. Firstly, the lists of things that can cause cancer are wildly different, from ionising radiation to burnt food, viruses, asbestos. The list is endless. And the way of trying to tie these all together is to say that they cause damage to genes, which then go on to drive cancer. But we now know that any damage that's found is actually completely random. There's no pattern to it that could predict an outcome like cancer. And the final nail in the coffin of this way of thinking is that in some instances, there isn't any damage found at all. You then homed in on one of the hallmarks in particular that seems to be more important than the others, hallmark 7, known as the Warburg effect, which describes the distinctive metabolism or energy system of cancer cells. You identify that this can't really be satisfactorily explained by anyone, and yet most of the other hallmark behaviours occur as a result of it. So it's a key hallmark to investigate. So that's where we left it. And now I want to pick up directly from there and ask you where your investigations into Hallmark 7 took you.
Okay, thank you, Robin. Yes, it was interesting identifying Hallmark 7 as one of the key hallmarks. So from that conclusion, I began to look at the different possible aspects of biology that could explain the switch to glycolysis that occurs that Hallmark 7 refers to. So we're talking about aerobic fermentation here, or aerobic glycolysis. And in doing so, I was trying to identify the underlying mechanism that was driving Hallmark 7 that could possibly explain all the other hallmarks of cancer as well. And this led me through a process of looking at say exercise, for instance, because that stimulates glycolysis. If you overly exercise to a certain degree, you're using both systems. Insulin resistance would be another one, because insulin stimulates the use of glycolysis. Hypoxia, inflammation, iron overload, and glucose abundance, all these different aspects, as well as faulty mitochondria and DNA mutation. Now, at this point, I'd gone through the process of looking at faulty mitochondria, you understanding the process of defective OXPHOS put forward by the metabolic theory and DNA mutation, and I've discounted them. So this is why I'm looking at these other aspects to try and determine what else stimulates glycolysis. So in the sense of insulin resistance, what I found to be against this aspect was that not all patients appear to harbor insulin resistance. So always think that when I'm looking at this process as well, I'm trying to see the process as being caused by one particular predominant factor. So I'm assuming, looking at the consistency of the disease, that I've already concluded that there will be potentially an underlying mechanism that's driving the disease. So I mean, we'll touch on the multifactorial aspect of cancer shortly, I'm sure. So as I'm looking through insulin resistance, I'm finding that approximately 60% in several studies show that people have insulin resistance, but it's not present in all of them. So from that perspective, insulin resistance cannot be the underlying driving mechanism of cancer in general.
Right.
Arguably, people who will look from the multifactorial angle will say, well, that's just part of it. But I'm looking at it from this different perspective of trying to identify an underlying mechanism. So then we come to hypoxia. And the obvious issue there with hypoxia is that glycolysis occurs in the presence of oxygen. So
just to be clear, hypoxia means a shortage of oxygen.
Yes, a lack of oxygen. So hypoxia, when there's a lack of oxygen, obviously mitochondria are unable to produce energy via OXPHOS, so glycolysis will be instigated to adapt to those situations to provide the ATP energy needed until the oxygen supply is resupplied. But in cancer, even though there's sufficient oxygen present, glycolysis is stimulated. So
just to refer that back to what we talked about last week, so this is the Warburg effect. It's not just that it switches from using oxygen to glycolysis, it's that it does it when it doesn't need to, because there's plenty of oxygen around. That's the kind of defining factor of a cancer cell.
Yes, so, yeah, and it's referred to quite correctly as aerobic fermentation. So fermentation happening or glycolysis happening even in the presence of oxygen. And obviously this is what Otto Warburg identified as being the Warburg effect. And because there's oxygen present and mitochondria should technically be creating energy when there's oxygen present, this led to the conclusion that mitochondria are faulty, which obviously led to the metabolic theory. So we have inflammation as well. Now, inflammation is a precursor to cancer and quite a number of other diseases. But it appears more so that inflammation is an effect of other factors rather than the actual underlying cause. It plays an intrinsic role, which will be defined later, but it's an effect, not necessarily a cause. Now, iron overload is another one. Now, this can stimulate glycolysis through the mechanism of damaging mitochondria. We've already established through this that faulty mitochondria are potentially not the underlying mechanism involved. And then you have glucose abundance. Now, this, in particular studies in the lab, when you're growing cells on a glucose substrate, this can stimulate glycolysis even in the presence of oxygen, which would suggest that mitochondria are faulty. This is known as the Crabtree effect and doesn't actually signify that mitochondria are faulty. It's just a case of where there is an abundance of glucose, the body will tend to utilize glycolysis because it consumes far more glucose in order to reduce the level of glucose in the surrounding tissue. And of course, the other one I mentioned was right at the beginning was exercise. Exercise stimulates glycolysis, depending on how intensity of that exercise is. But that can't be the underlying mechanism driving cancer because exercise has been found to be a massive preventative measure, up to 60% preventative in cancer. So,
So there are six things there that you looked into as all things which are known to be able to play some part in the Wahlberg effect.
Yeah.
But for one reason or another, you dismissed each of those as being fundamentally to do with driving cancer.
Yeah. And there's bound to be more that I haven't covered.
Okay.
But these are the main ones that I've identified.
Okay. So, okay, you're empty-handed at that point. Where did you go next?
Well, that was the moment at which, through all the other research I was doing, remember that this time I'm literally looking into everything, every possibility. So this wasn't such a linear process all the time. It wasn't like I took this and went, oh, well, here's the six. I was building this model constantly, adding to, oh, right, so later on, oh, glucose abundance can cause glycolysis. So I had this in mind as I was going through all this other area of study. And I've later developed them into a easy format to understand. So as I continued on my research, I was looking at infection, bacteria, viral and fungal infections, and parasitic infections as well. And I came across a couple of studies that suggested within the body of the results that a Wahlberg-like effect had been initiated. And that caused me to sit back and pause, because I wasn't looking specifically at that point for an explanation for the Wahlberg effect. I was just trying to understand how microorganisms interact with the body. And that just jumped out at me. It was almost like a light bulb moment. I was like, okay. But I'm looking for an explanation for the Wahlberg effect, and here we have an infectious agent potentially stimulating a Wahlberg-like effect. So let's look more into this, and that's what I did. I then found subsequent evidence confirming in many situations, not only in immune cells but in epithelial cells, when they are challenged with an infectious agent of some kind, a pathogen, they actually resort to instigating the Wahlberg effect. So glycolysis is instigated in spite of abundant oxygen present.
Amazing. So, you know, this is, to me, is absolutely major. Firstly, it's a well-known mechanism that's actually called a Wahlberg-like effect. It's not like beating around the bush, all right? That could exist in infectious diseases and never be mentioned in cancer circles. I mean, when you told me this, I was utterly shocked that I'd never heard of such a thing in almost two decades of years to life. I was like, what? You mean there's something happening over there in infectious diseases? I mean, how do you think this could have occurred, that this effect was kind of so off-piste, if you like, from cancer?
I think it's because, at the end of the day, the human body is incredibly, incredibly complex. And that's why I suppose medicine is broken down into many different areas. And these areas specialize in the complexity within each field. And I think it will probably be, I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but I'm assuming it's probably to do with maybe the so much complexity between each field means that each discipline doesn't necessarily communicate directly with each other as much as you would need to probably solve a problem such as this.
Mm. Well, that does make sense. But anyway, considering they actually named it after the Wahlberg effect, which is specifically about cancer, it's just extraordinary to me. Because, I mean, you were telling me not just that you came across this thing, which was a surprise, but you then made the assumption, well, of course, they must have looked into this and discounted it as being anything to do with cancer. But you found out it wasn't the case.
Yeah, so I think my initial surprise was that it was mentioned as such, and I didn't pursue it because I was just more interested in understanding mechanisms of invasion and how infection plays out in the body. And it was only when I came back to it, when I realized, I tried to search for information to do with infection involved in cancer, because obviously it's recognized that about 20% of infection is related to causing cancer. When I looked at that, those infections, those oncogenic viruses and certain bacteria, such as Helicobacter pylori, that increases the risk of gastric cancer, there was no explanation of this Warburg-like effect in the sense that these infectious agents weren't causing a switch in energy metabolism. And I think the reason for this is probably based on the fact that most oncologists are looking purely at this from a somatic mutation viewpoint,
right,
rather than a metabolic viewpoint. So at this point, I'd studied the metabolic theory as well, and I kind of acknowledged and realized that the metabolic theory wasn't really at the forefront of the minds of a lot of these scientists looking into cancer. So I could rationalize why they maybe hadn't seen this link. But at the same time, I realized when I looked at this infectious side of things that was recognized within the mainstream as being a potential cause or risk factor of cancer, I realized that it was these infectious agents weren't being looked at from this angle of causing this energy switch. They were looking at it from the angle of causing DNA damage to the cell.
Right.
So that's when I pursued more research into looking at the Mach 7.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
That does make sense. And of course, if you'd presented Otto Warburg with this information, he'd have got pretty hot under the collar immediately, I would say. You're right. The Warburg effect is something that's acknowledged by everybody. Nobody says it doesn't exist or it's not true or anything. Everybody appreciates that it happens, but it's the amount of significance attached to it that varies, whereas the metabolic theorists attach huge significance to it. The somatic mutation theorists it's just one of the things that happens with cancer. It's like a symptom.
Yeah, and that's kind of surprised me as well. And because there doesn't appear to be, like I say, that there's a siloing even within cancer science between the theorists. I was quite shocked that proponents of the somatic mutation theory kind of not necessarily ignore, but focus all their attention on that theory and don't tend to stray into the field of other theories as such.
If it was a well-supported theory that actually there was plenty of evidence for, that would be fair enough, I think. You'd be backing the front horse, so to speak. But given the fact it's got evidence to show that it's actually not true these days, you could say it was disproven by the fact they now know that some cancers don't have any DNA mutations. That pretty much disproves the somatic mutation theory in my book.
Yes. But again, there's this aspect of cancer that is multifactorial. So I suppose proponents of the somatic mutation theory will say that, well, okay, those particular cancers that don't harbour any driver DNA mutations are likely caused by something else, another mechanism. And I suppose that's as kind of an explanation, almost an excuse, but a way of explaining away the controversies of the somatic mutation theory, in a sense. Mm.
Okay. So I just want to go over one thing which I think is very important to the population at large, and that is that what you've just described is a very different story to the narrative we've been fed forever by the medical world and the media about sort of mutant cells somehow getting a mind of their own, becoming sort of evil and self-interested and attacking us from within. It seems to be something between a 1950s sci-fi and a religious notion to me. And now we find out that the central behaviour of cancer cells could be depicted as a normal, natural method of defence against infection. A completely different ball game, basically. And just hearing that, my common sense meter is bouncing off the top end. It's actually a relief to hear something that fits in with everything else we know about our bodies and the way they act to continually keep us safe and well in every circumstance. So I think, you know, that's a very important aspect of it. So you mentioned this multifactorial thing several times. This is a big deal, really, isn't it, and something we should speak about. So this is the mainstream view of cancer, and, in fact, it goes, I would say, beyond mainstream. It is the view of cancer generally held everywhere by most theorists.
Yeah, so the I think the idea pretty much springs from the concept that in somatic mutation theory is unable to fully explain the disease, especially given the randomness of the mutations that appear to occur. As well as this, you have the introduction of all these carcinogens and how different and varied they are and the different damage that they cause. So what you have is an amalgamation of a huge abundance of randomness, essentially. So how do you explain that randomness? How do you explain that causes the consistency of the disease? Well, the only way of really rationalizing it, if you are still in support of the somatic mutation theory, is to actually claim that it's a multifactorial disease that can be caused by a multitude of different mutations and different levels of damage to different parts of the cell. That would then make the disease incredibly complex and give more time to try and to carry on with this perspective, I suppose, to try and work out exactly what's going on. But that doesn't seem to make sense in terms of the disease being consistent. The other notion is, obviously, that just maybe the somatic mutation theory has misinterpreted the underlying mechanism causing the disease. So the multifactorial aspect is trying to explain away, in effect, the inability of randomness to cause consistency by stating that so many different factors possibly could cause the disease. Now, I think there's two aspects to the multifactorial side of things that need to be mentioned. One is that, obviously, carcinogens that I mentioned earlier, there's so many of them and they cause an incredible amount of damage to varying degrees. That side of cancer is multifactorial, in the sense that so many different carcinogens appear to drive the disease. So I'm in agreement with that aspect of the multifactorial trigger, if you like, of cancer.
Okay.
What I'm not in agreement with is the multifactorial mechanism that drives the disease, that randomness can cause consistency, which brings us back to hallmark 7 and the consistency of the influence of infectious agents or microorganisms. Because that, like you say, it provides a consistency to the mechanism that drives this switch in metabolism.
Okay, understood. Well, look, we're going to come back round to how you would explain how all these different carcinogens can seem to lead to the same disease a bit later. But for now, I'd like to come back to the path we were on and go a bit further with finding out a bit more about this Warburg-like effect, because there's been some recent science on cell behaviour that plays right into your story in a remarkable way. So do you want to tell us a bit more about that?
Yes. Yeah, so Dr. Navio is a scientist who has been trying to explain chronic disease through a metabolic perspective. Now, he's created a model called the cell danger response model, which has been looking at how the cell reacts to certain threats. Now, when I looked at his model in terms of infection, it goes something like this. Okay, sorry, before I go through that process, I'll just quickly explain. There are three aspects to Navio's model. The cell danger response 1, or CDR1, CDR2, and CDR3. CDR1 is about containment and innate immunity. So it deals with a response to, say, an infectious agent and hopefully kills that infectious agent. CDR2 is the second phase, and it moves to this phase once the infectious agent is killed. That's the phase of aerobic glycolysis and proliferation. So essentially cell repair. And then once cell repair has completed its task, we go to the CDR3 phase, which is differentiation and development. And it's essentially a return back to homeostasis, back to the original state of the cell. Now, if we are to look at how an infectious agent or a pathogen invades a cell and the response to that, once a pathogen is detected by a cell, and this is an epithelial cell as well as an immune cell.
Explain what an epithelial cell is, will you?
An epithelial cell is a type of cell that essentially lines most of the outer layers of the body. Essentially, skin is an epithelial cell layer. Mucus layers, the layer that surrounds your lungs and various organs. So these epithelial cells are essentially the cells, the outer barrier, if you will, of cells that infectious agents come into contact with. So upon detection of a pathogen of any kind, through the cell danger response, CDR1 phase, the cell will... And this is quite interesting. The cell will intentionally, or the mitochondria, I should say, will intentionally restrict OxPhos. This is for the purpose of flooding the cytosol, the inner part of the cell, with oxygen. The priority here is to prevent the ability of the invading pathogen to synthesize proteins, RNA, and DNA. So it's a response to inhibit the infectious process. Now, that is essentially what kind of happens in with the Warburg effect. So because the mitochondria are trying to deal with the infection by blocking OxPhos, essentially, glycolysis is instigated during this infection process. So what we have here is an infectious agent coming into the cell, mitochondria intentionally restricting OxPhos to use the oxygen to target and restrict the pathogen whilst glycolysis is increased in the presence of sufficient oxygen in the surrounding tissue, which is essentially the Warburg effect.
Right. So just to be clear then, so what it, by switching over to the backup energy system, all the oxygen is then available to be used as a weapon, basically, against the invading pathogen.
Yeah, to inhibit the pathogen's ability to take control of cell pathways. So, and what we find as well is in other studies of infectious agents, if the infection persists within the cell, if the CDR phase, the containment and elimination of the pathogen isn't complete and ineffective, then this energy switch to glycolysis is sustained until the pathogen is eliminated. So it appears, if you're looking at Dr. Navio's model, the cell with an intracellular infectious agent present is stuck between the process of CDR1 and CDR2, which is where the cell is attempting to obviously continue to kill the pathogen, but also is stuck in this process of aerobic glycolysis, which is a proliferative state, which perfectly explains the Warburg effect, or hallmark.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
A for horses, B for mutton, C more cheeks, dig for victory, E bar gold.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle Magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better.
Marks and Spencer.
Add Health Triangle Magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
T for two.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, so there you've stepped across into cancer there, Swathi, in as much as you're saying that the Warburg effect is obviously not just a one-off of cleaning up a cell and then it finishes. It's actually protracted. It keeps going. And the reason for this being stuck between these two phases of Navio's cell danger response is because it hasn't succeeded in killing the infection. So it's actually busy all the time trying to kill this infection, which looks like a consistent switch to glycolysis.
Absolutely. And until that infection is eliminated, then the process won't be able to move to CDR3 and back to homeostasis.
Right, right. Very interesting. So, looked at in terms of where we've placed Hallmark 7 in the overall scope of things, and now you've come up with a known mechanism that actually does actually kick off the Warburg effect and maintain it, with all the other hallmarks being downstream of Hallmark 7, all kind of results of Hallmark 7. You've actually come up with a mechanism which could be the driver of cancer.
Well, yes.
Yeah, amazing. Okay, so a little bit of compare and contrast. I mean, I've already alluded to the mainstream narrative which puts the blame, if that's the right word, squarely on the rogue cell for causing all the trouble. There's a crucial way in which your explanation of cancer differs from all the other attempts at explanation. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yes. So when I was looking at all the other theories and analysing them, it became apparent that they all tend to view the disease from pretty much the same paradigm, which is that carcinogens and infection causes inflammation and cell damage, which results in cell malfunction, which is the cell gone rogue aspect you're talking about.
Right.
So with the cell malfunctioning or becoming faulty in a particular way, it almost gains autonomy. It's broken free from its restraints of growth signaling and cell death, and it's developed a mind of its own, essentially. So the cell malfunction concept of the cell being blamed or the cell going wrong kind of underpins most of the mainstream theories. And then that also moves into the realm of randomness again. The damage to the cell is the problem. And then it's the randomness of the damage that then causes the consistency of the disease, which again doesn't sit well with me because we can't find or uncover the specific randomness or the specific damage or replicate the specific damage that we think is responsible. So from this concept of looking at this infectious agent coming into the cell, triggering Dr. Navio's CDR response and the Warburg effect and sustaining it, I realized that there's potentially a completely different mechanism driving the disease, which is that of cell suppression. So in this instance, carcinogens would cause the inflammation and cell damage, and that would enable infection to occur. And once the infection takes hold, that infectious agent, that pathogen, suppresses specific cell mechanisms, which then leads to the rest of the conditions of the disease.
Very interesting. So this is the very heart of your new proposal for the mechanism, and indeed then the origin of cancer. So you've talked about this now as cell suppression, and you've contrasted that with cell malfunction, which everybody else is talking about, basically. Regardless of theory, everybody says some bit of the cancer cell's gone wrong. They argue about which bit, but it's the same idea. Essentially, you've got this cell which is autonomous and is not in line with the rest of the body all of a sudden. You're describing the cell as kind of a victim of circumstances here.
Yeah.
And as I've already said, the effect for me of understanding this was a sort of moment in which, you know, the relentless march of cancer began to fit in with everything else that I know about the human body, nature, and health. The weird behavior of cancer cells is no longer attributed to some, dare I say, woo-woo idea. They've developed a mind of their own and are like sort of zombies who've been irrevocably turned to the dark side. They've simply been overcome by a parasitic pathogen, and despite their most valiant efforts to keep us well, are being exploited for the benefit of the pathogen. So, in other words, they're acting like aliens that want to take over our bodies, because they really are being driven by aliens whose success is at our expense. This is like any infection scenario. It's us versus invading bugs. So the whole thing begins to make some sort of sense, and as I say, to line up with what we know about the human body and nature. So do you want to just go over this most important part of what you described about cell suppression versus cell malfunction? I just want to make quite sure everybody understands the difference between the two models.
Yeah, okay. Well, the cell suppression model, as you just described, as I've put it forward, would be that evolutionary programming, or millions of years of evolutionary programming, has our cells working together commensurately. And what's happening here is that because of our poor diets and overexposure to certain toxins that we now have in the environment, the control mechanisms within the cell are becoming damaged, and the surrounding tissue, and that allows these pathogens to take hold. So all the while this pathogen's invading the cell and trying to do its thing of sequestering nutrients and suppressing the cell's response in defense, the cell is trying desperately to commit apoptosis. It's trying desperately to commit cell death.
Which is what it should do.
Which is what it should do. So the cell is trying to do what it should do. But the outcome of the failure to eliminate the pathogen results in a cascade of the conditions we call cancer, essentially. And so when you go through this whole process and you look at cancer through the lens of a pathogen and this cell suppression paradigm, all the different aspects of the disease, angiogenesis, metastasis, random DNA damage, immune evasion, all these aspects begin to make sense. And the different ways cells or tumors tend to use different fuels at different periods can all be related to this battle between the cell trying to protect you against this infectious agent. It nicely explains all these the abnormal behavior that simply occurs. And if we're to switch it and look at the cell malfunction side, it's very difficult to quantify the personality of a cell and analyze a cell gone rogue. You can't I mean, we're saying here that a cell's developed a mind of its own. It's developed a personality. That's great theoretically and hypothetically, but we can't measure that or do anything about that in terms of treatment. And it doesn't explain, it doesn't help to explain the reasons why something happens, why certain damage occurs, or why the cell operates in the way that it does. It's just a way of trying to rationalize the randomness that we think causes the disease. But it's not an end point to itself. You can't measure the personality of the cell or change it, the personality of the cell, if that's what you believe is driving the mechanism of cancer. And that way, if you're looking at it from that perspective, you're going to try and kill the cell. Because that's the only thing, because you think it's been turned evil. But that has negative connotations for patients, because I suppose you'll attack yourself mentally because you're thinking, well, why is my body attacking itself? When in effect, it's probably not attacking itself. It's doing its best to defend you. It just is overwhelmed by this process of invasion by this particular pathogen.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, obviously, the biochemistry of this is enormously important. You're saying something quite different. But that other aspect, which is the psychological and emotional relationship we have to the disease called cancer, is also hugely important, both in the terms of our relationship to life generally and our trust in life, but also in relation to how we try and treat the disease. If we think it's something evil that's trying to kill us, then we'll use any measure, however vile, to try and kill it. But if we think that it's actually ourselves doing their damnedest to keep us well, then what will we do? We'll try and help them. We'll actually support them in doing that job. That is a much more obvious route to take. So I think it's enormously important, this kind of rewriting of the story. And I think it's very important to point to the aspects of the general myth that are just so utterly unrealistic and unscientific. This mind of its own cell thing, it doesn't mean anything to me at all. I mean, cells don't have minds. You know, they basically are part of us and they're always acting to keep us whole and well.
Yeah, they're working collectively. And can I just interject there?
Yeah.
And give a quick example. So migrating cancer cells tend to have a protein on their surfaces called galectin-3. It's expressed quite extensively on a number of migrating cancer cells. So if you look at the cell malfunction side of things, the cell's gone rogue and it's to blame. When I've looked at studies into this, scientists have concluded that, well, you know, the solution is to block the gene that produces galectin-3, which is a sticky protein, okay, because this enables migrating cancer cells to stick to other areas of the body, which allows it to spread. So the thinking behind it under the cell malfunction paradigm is that the cell is purposely generating this sticky protein in order to advance. But there is, if you look from the cell suppression perspective and the infection perspective, there's a completely different interpretation of the same data. So galectin-3 is an antimicrobial protein that's issued against particular pathogens. So one could argue that what the body's trying to do at this latter stage, when a cluster of cells are migrating from the initial tumor site through the bloodstream, they're trying desperately to actually kill whatever microorganism is present within that cluster of migrating cancer cells. And so they're bombarded with this galectin-3 protein. Now, that tells you that the body's working for you in under this cell suppression paradigm. But the problem is, because the whether it's because the immune system is weak or whether it's because the infection is protected within that cluster of migrating cancer cells because there's stem cells involved maybe, then this overproduction of galectin-3 and this desperate attempt to defeat the pathogen actually enables the migrating cancer cells to then stick to a site in another part of the body. So it's an accidental occurrence from the attempt of the failed attempt of the body to essentially suppress the infection.
Well, very interesting. Yeah, completely different story. Same observation, but completely different conclusions. Yeah, really interesting. Okay, well, look, we're about coming to the end of today. I want to point towards what we're going to start off with next week. I want to go in. You've already mentioned some of these sort of contributing factors. Where do they fit into the picture? That's where I want to start off next week. You already mentioned inflammation, for example, as being a contributing factor to all cancers. And it obviously gets in there somewhere, but you're placing it in a different position in relation to cancer than anybody else is, I think. And so it'll be very interesting to hear about all those contributing factors and what actual role they place in it. So that's where we'll hit the ground next week. So big thank you again for today. Lots of complex stuff we've gone through. Thanks for taking the time and trouble to really do the detail.
No problem. It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you're able to follow that okay. A little science heavy for many listeners, but it is well worth taking the trouble to understand Mark's perspective for yourself, at least in broad terms. For any of you listening who have a time imperative hanging over you and who literally aren't in a position to wait for the coming episodes, Mark has compiled all his findings with their scientific references into a book called The Cancer Resolution. This is not published yet, it's scheduled for late spring, but he has released a pre-publication extract of all the key chapters titled Cancer Through Another Lens, which is available for download from the Yes to Life online store, which you can find by going to the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk, and clicking the link to the online store right at the very top of any page. Furthermore, we'll shortly be releasing three videos of Mark presenting his findings, which will also be available in the online store. These videos and the pre-publication book extract will also be of interest to practitioners interested to know more. Also, if you're someone with cancer who would like professional support in evaluating the impact that Mark's findings could have on your situation, the Yes to Life helpline can supply details of practitioners ready and willing to help. You can call the helpline on 0870 163 2990. Or alternatively, use the web form on the website by choosing the I'm New Here menu and selecting our helpline. I want to end today by letting you all know about the Yes to Life conferences for 2023. This year, we are pairing a one-day online conference with our annual in-person conference under the joint banner of You and Your Cancer Team. Across the two events, we have a seriously impressive array of experience and expertise in the form of our speakers and workshop leaders. Part 1, the online element, is subtitled Building Your Cancer Team, and features many specialists who have appeared here on the Yes to Life show, including Kirsten Chick, who has been instrumental in devising the programme for both events, Sophie Drew, Dr. Catherine Zollman, Scarlett Roberts, Isabel Galliano, Tracy Story and Hayley Norton. The subtitle for the annual conference will be held once again in the autumn in the fabulous Friends House, Euston, London, is Working With Your Integrative Team. Speakers include Kirsten Chick again, Dr. Sam Watts and Patricia Pete, with workshops led by Aga Kahinda, Dr. Britt Cordy, Maria Sardina, Claire Winterbourne, Catalina De Anna Portella, Dr. Shireen Kassam, Sophie True, members of the Yes to Life team, the list goes on. A veritable feast of resources combined with exhibitor stands where you can talk to suppliers, therapists, etc. about what they have on offer. There's a bundle price for tickets to both, and as always, the prices are as low as possible, below cost, in fact, in order to support those with limited means as best we can. There's a dedicated website at yestolifeannualconference.org, or you can navigate from the main Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk, if you look under events. Thanks very much for listening today. I'll be back with part 4 of Cancer Through Another Lens next week here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.